Hello. Today is Friday, April 9th, 2021. I am Stephanie Valance here with Jamie Partridge, and we are in our respective homes over Zoom, continuing with our oral history today. So we are going to start with some of the more recent efforts that Jamie has been working on, and by recent meaning in the last 6 or 7 years. Some of them including things that we have touched upon previously in other times that we've spoken, though not necessarily as their own subjects. So those include things like the 15 Now campaign, Portland Tenants United, Don't Shoot Portland, Disarm PSU, and the DSA Labor Working Group. So, Jamie, what should we start with? Do you want to pick up with the 15 Now campaign?
Sure. Right. So, this is in 2014 that I believe it's 2014, something around there. Excitement about fighting for a $15 minimum wage actually came to fruition and win at SeaTac, which was the town that encompasses the Seattle-Tacoma Airport, with a ballot measure, and came off of an amazing union organizing drive at the airport itself among immigrant workers, actually Muslim immigrant workers who were fighting for prayer time. And that whole organizing effort, which won, extended to this going after a $15 minimum wage, which won on a ballot measure. And then the city of Seattle took it up, and it became part of a socialist candidate for city council, Shama Swant, and her campaign riding on the $15 minimum wage movement. She swept into office, and the campaign was threatening a ballot initiative, and the city council implemented a $15 minimum wage for city of Seattle. And so in Portland, we got excited, and I was part of, at that point, the International Socialist Organization, which was largely based at PSU campus. And I tried to get my socialist organization involved, and they weren't particularly interested. And so I just stepped into what was already happening, which was this guy who had never met before, Justin Norton Kurtzen, had launched these every Wednesday rallies for a $15 minimum wage. But there was like no plan, no strategy, just like rallies every Wednesday in front of City Hall. And then out of that momentum, a candidate stepped forward, to Nick Caleb, to run for city council with on the $15 minimum wage demand, and trying to replicate what happened in Seattle, and then we discovered that the state of Oregon had preemptively prohibited cities from raising their own minimum wages. That only the state of Oregon could raise the minimum wage, and so we were faced with this dilemma of attempting to what did we do first? I think the first thing we did, the first thing we did was we went after amending the living wage ordinance, which I had been part of passing back, a decade earlier, to include raising to $15 the minimum wage for contracted workers at, the janitors, security guards, parking lot attendants, the companies, the private companies that did business with the city, contracted with the city. And we did accomplish that. And it was a, you know, a series of, you know, town halls and rallies and lobbying efforts. And it was fairly easy lift to get the city to pass that, you know, to raise the level for contracted workers. And shortly thereafter, the city workers as well generally won $15 minimum wage. And by that point, we had made contact with interested parties in places like Salem, Eugene, Medford, and even out to the coast and along in the gorge, to launch a statewide $15 minimum wage campaign. And having been involved with several statewide ballot measure campaigns, some of which, you know, a couple of minimum wage campaigns which had won, but certainly the big loser was the Healthcare for All campaign that I was involved with in 2002. It's quite a daunting effort. And, you know, we had to collect, I think it was 90,000, something like that, signatures. And so at some, yeah, okay. So at I guess what we decided was this, I can't remember how we made these decisions actually, that we would do the usual route, which is to go to the legislature first, not really expecting to win, but using that to build momentum for a ballot initiative and threatening a ballot initiative as a way to get the legislature to move. And we actually effectively convinced all of the, you know, the labor movement, the AFL-CIO, the teachers union, the SEIU, to get behind a 15 Now campaign. That was what it was labeled, 15 Now. And we had a big rally, kickoff rally in January before the 2015, is that right, legislative session, you know, where Tom Chamberlain, the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, was leading the rally. And we had a later rally at the state capitol where we sat in the governor's office. And, oh, no, that was later. Well, first of all, we marched through the different offices. Maybe I told you about this already. It was a different kind of lobbying. We were basically taking groups of people, marching from office to office to office and saying, you know, hey, you better support this $15 minimum wage. And we had 15 sponsors with that. That was cute. In the House and the Senate. And, you know, if you don't, we're going to go to the ballot, and it's highly, you know, very popular, and it's going to win. And we, at a certain point, launched the ballot initiative and the signature gathering. Let's see. Oh, I get confused about the timeline. Okay, so that, yeah, so that would
go. Did it go in front of the legislature, or?
Well, it never. We never even got a hearing at the legislature.
Got it.
Or did we? God, oh God. I've been to so many hearings at the state legislature. I can't remember. And actually, it must have, because I remember being there with all our T-shirts, our 15 Now T-shirts, and we actually. Yeah, for there was a period of time early on where we were being polite and nice, and you know, we were going around and having meetings and getting sponsors, and it was mostly, you know, from the Portland area, the more progressive Democrats that signed on, and then and we did have some hearings, but it never got to the floor, and. So we launched our ballot initiative, and I made a commitment right up front that I was going to collect 15,000 signatures. It's amazing when I think about it, that I was going to go out every day and collect at least a couple hundred signatures every day. And it was like, I was like, you know, trying to model for all this huge, we had hundreds of, you know, volunteers. And then I, at the same time, was coordinating the, you know, the deployment of signature gathering. And so we were doing it, you know, on downtown on the bus mall around the Pioneer Courthouse Square at, you know, farmers markets, at any gathering places. You know, during the summer, of course, it was great when you could, you know, go to these different street festivals and stuff, but any place where there were large gatherings of people. And like, we would hit the lines at the Blazer games, or at, you know, outside of concerts, you know, or big, you know, any kind of place where there was a line was perfect, because you would just go to the front of the line and then work toward the back. And, you know, people were just stuck. They couldn't get away from you. But my favorite, and I really enjoyed that whole multi-month period where it was my work, because I was, you know, retired, right? But then my favorite was going to the riding the MAX trains. Did I tell you about this? I must have, because it's so exciting. It was so exciting to me. I must have told you about it already. No?
Tell me and I'll tell you.
Okay. So I'd go to the Starbucks next to the Rose Quarter MAX stations, where there was, you know, like three different, there was like the yellow line and the red line, the blue line, the green line all came together at that same place. And I would get there 6 o'clock maybe in the morning, and you know, ride the trains to intersect with the rush hour crowd, the people going to work. And the trains would be just packed. And I would go in with like four clipboards, four or five, and would start passing them down the rows of people. And I would, you know, make these speeches about the $15 minimum wage. And so, you know, about 10 people could hear me while I, you know, and, you know, people reach out for the clipboard. And, you know, I remember regularly getting hundreds of signatures, you know, in just an hour or so in the morning. And just having these amazing interactions with people, you know, which, you know, so that you would have these debates and stuff that tons of people would be involved with. And I would go, and also just having the experience of traveling all the way out to, you know, on the west side, out past Beaverton to wherever, Hillsboro, wherever the train goes, and then east going all the way out to going on the Orange Line to Milwaukee, and then going out, you know, to the Gateway Transit Center and out that way, and the airport, and just the different sets of people. And I once had an Oregonian reporter go with me, and did a report, which was really helpful to the campaign. Maybe a television person too, but it was so much fun meeting all these different people, and the issue was just so easy, you know. I mean, of course people want to raise the minimum wage, I'm trying to think what else about that campaign. Well, so moving away from that fun experience, we got to the place where we maybe were at half of the signatures that we needed, and we were into the 2016, was that right? That's all right. Legislative session. And we were, again, you know, saying, look, we're going to take this to the ballot if you don't do something. And they, all of our allies in the labor movement, no, first of all, Tina Kotek, the Speaker of the House, said, well, we can go for $13.50. And then immediately, all of our allies in the labor movement went, oh, okay, $13.50. And it was so disappointing and so like, oh my God, the labor movement is just totally wedded to the Democrats and whatever the Democrats want to do. And then of course that was the point where I was also working behind the scenes with my friend Stan Amey. That was what I talked to you about, right?
Yes.
So they came up with this three-tiered phased in minimum wage raise, which were brought, you know, by 2022, which was 6 years from then, but 2 years from now, or no, 1 year from now, the minimum wage in the metro area will be $14.75. They wouldn't give us $15, $14.75. But down the valley, it'll only go to $13.50, and then in rural areas will only go to $12.50, which is like, you know, and especially places like Medford and Bend, any place outside the valley, you know, cost of living is, it's rough, you know, $12.50 is, I mean, versus $14.75. And of course it's racist too, because, you know, the Latinx population is largely outside the valley and doing, you know, farm work and that. Anyway, so that's what we ended up with, but it was, I mean, we were so bitter about what had happened with our allies that we did this big occupation of the Capitol, where we just took a bunch of people inside, and we this was the day that they were going to vote on this, you know, this three-tiered thing, and we occupied the governor's office. And then some of us broke off, and this wasn't planned, and went down to the I think it was the House side of the Capitol, and we were going to go into the gallery, and the guards prevented us from getting into the gallery, and so people started banging on the door, and you know, taking off their shoes and banging on the wall, and according to the people that were on the inside, it was really loud, and people were really scared. And they didn't, they ended up voting, to pass this three-tiered thing, but that's just who we are, us rabble-rousing militants. And we ended up, you know, writing some nasty things about our about what happened with the 15, but it was really quite an accomplishment, given, you know, that we had started at, where were we, at 9-something, you know, 2 years earlier. So we, you know, significantly are raising the minimum wage. And of course, 15 is still, here we are 6 years later, on the docket, but actually, you know, just passed in the state of Florida. You know, it's still a happening thing. Although not at the federal level is stuck at 725. So, what the final piece to the 15 Now campaign we took it to PSU, to the campus, and we did a big petition campaign and pushed on the Board of Trustees to raise the wage, and we were unsuccessful. For, you know, student workers. So let's leave that to talk about
do you want to stay on the Portland State
sure
subject and talk about Don't Shoot?
Sure.
Or not. Yeah,
Sure. Yeah. So the so a major struggle at the time that I was involved with the International Socialist Organization at the PSU campus, which was between 2011 and 2018. The Disarm PSU campaign was a big item that that the police the campus security were the board voted to arm and deputize the campus security, that is that they became basically an arm of the Portland Police Department. And the there was some, you know, huge rallies and a number of times that we took over the board of trustees meetings. And there was various ways that they attempted. Well, first of all, they were quite surprised the first time we did it. And when they walked out, you know, which is a common tactic for, this has happened when I've been part of taking over school board meetings, you know, the board just gets up and walks out. And they attend, so we just, you know, like the first time we took over we just took over the meeting and continued the testimony. And so a number of us, you know, went up and sat in the seats of the trustees and listened to people give testimony. And then the second time that happened, maybe it's the third time, we realized somebody tipped us off that the board was meeting in another room in another building, and continuing their meeting and maybe broadcasting an audio. I don't know if they were, but and we figured out where they were, and so we took a crew of a bunch of us to the, you know, blocks away to the engineering building and down into the basement and found them. And disrupted that meeting, chanting "Disarm PSU." But of course, the movement took on particular intensity when Jason Washington was killed by Portland State University Police. When he was attempting to break up a fight outside of the Cheerful Tortoise, which is a tavern near Portland State campus. And you know, being a Black man and being a letter carrier, it was like another in the line of police killings of Black men, and a particularly hit home for us in the Letter Carriers Union, because he was not only well liked, but he was a shop steward. He was a, you know, union man. And so there was a whole series of continuing actions around disarming PSU, which then when COVID hit and nobody was on campus, one of the cops who had Willie Halliburton, who I knew from having been arrested by him when we were doing an occupation of a post office, had transferred to the PSU police campus security. And by the time COVID hit, had become the head of PSU campus security. He made the decision on his own to disarm the PSU cops. And it was so interesting. We always talked about Willie as officer friendly, because he was always trying to, you know, be friends with the students, and he would, you know, engage in various frivolous things, and he had long dreadlocks. And by the time he was the head of campus security, of course, he had shaved his head.
So the Disarm Portland State was going on prior to Jason Washington's death.
Oh, yeah.
For some reason. thought that that was what prompted it.
No. And in fact, there was a, there was an occupation of the campus security, the block around the building, that lasted weeks, it seems to me, where the students were camped out. And I'm trying to remember, it coincided with something else. I don't remember what it was. Oh, it was probably the, no, that couldn't be right, because it didn't happen during the pandemic. Or did it? No, it wasn't during the pandemic. So I don't, it seemed to me like it was, there was a bunch of other activity in the city that it coincided with, but I can't remember what it was. You know, these things, the assignment play, they play off of each other.
And so, the Portland State Security Force currently is unarmed.
Right.
And that happened within the, in the time of the pandemic.
Right.
Oh.
Yeah. And so when you go back to school or whenever, yeah, it won't be.
Okay. Armed. That was, yeah, that doesn't seem like that was, discussed widely or widely disseminated information. Maybe it was, and I missed.
Well, it was, but yeah. I mean, it's not like the Vanguard is coming out every, you know, every week, so you read it. But it was, you know, it was in the papers. Yeah.
Yeah.
But another cop story that leads me into this next campaign was. Sergeant, Lieutenant, oh God, what's his name? Oh, damn it. I'm sorry. It's important that I have his name correct, I think. He was another cop that had arrested me during the, our first post office occupation, and he was, I remember his response. Oh yeah, okay, Sergeant Jeff Nia, N-I-I-Y-A. And I remember his response, which was, oh, I know who these people are. These are the Occupy Portland people. You know, it's like, None of us had been involved with Occupy Portland, but he decided that's who we were. And but it happened around the same time, and certainly the, you know, the momentum of the occupation in, you know, Chapman and Lonsdale Square helped to give us the confidence and you know, to go ahead and occupy that post office. But anyway, so years later, Patriot Prayer was organizing, you know, this proto-fascist group, which it morphed into Proud Boys, and they were planning a. This was in 2017, so this was in the Trump era. Declared that they were going to. Oh, this is just after the killings on the white supremacist killings on the Max by good old what's his name, I can't remember, but in any case, there had been several rallies by white supremacists where this guy had showed up. I think one in East County, and so he was known to be associated with these groups, and then this killing happened of, I remember going to a rally where Ted Wheeler showed up, and saying, so Ted, you know, like, what are you going to do about these Patriot Prayer people? And you're going to let them, are you going to let them rally in down, you know, it was Terry Shrunk Plaza. And he was like, no, we shouldn't let them do it, but I can't because it's federal property and we can't stop it. And so a number of us are in our socialist group and connected with people in the immigrant rights movement and in the connected to the Don't Shoot Portland group and various faith groups like Unitarians and the Council on American Islamic Relations group all decided that we would do a counter demonstration and that we would, this was in the summer of 2017, and we would call ourselves Portland Stands United Against Hate. And I ended up, this was in our first meeting, which was at the Center for Intercultural Organizing. We said, well, who's gonna, you know, we need somebody to do, you know, to head up security. We need somebody to head up, to be, you know, head up communication, blah, blah, blah. So I ended up, not that I had ever done it, heading up security. And turned out that the person that I, in the police department that I got hooked up with to be the, you know, the cop talker, the liaison, was Sergeant Jeff Nia, who remembered me from having arrested me at the post office. We had a number of rallies and marches over the next year against counter demonstrations when the Proud Boys or the Patriot Prayer would come to town. And this, I had this, you know, this communication relationship with, Sergeant Jeff Nia, who was called out in the media for having had friendly connections with the Proud Boys, you know, according to the text involved, but also my text with him were also published. And I was called out by the Black Bloc, who were the other people who were, you know, countering the fascists with their less than nonviolent tactics. And so there was this whole big hoopla on the, you know, on Facebook and on the left about how Jamie Partridge was a police informer. And, you know, basically my approach to, have I talked to you about this already? Okay, never mind. Forget it.
Okay, I did not, we have talked about it and you have explained the reaction of those, of that group and their, you know, sort of call out of you. Mm-hmm. I think you told an anecdote about being at a rally and taking a picture and they...
Oh yeah, okay, so I told you all that.
Yeah, you did, but I did not know like sort of the lead up to it and how we got to that point.
Mm-hmm.
So just to clarify, Jeff Nia's text with... So Jeff Nia was texting with both the Proud Boys and with you.
Right.
And looking back on the texts
mm-hmm.
that came out that were yours,
yeah.
What is your like reflection on them? Do you feel like they were warranted? Did the reaction change your own view of that action?
No. Because I was very clear in my own thinking and in talking with the people I was supposed to be developing safety for, was that give the cops information that they already have, or that they can easily find, about what we're doing and what we're about, and try to get information from them about what they're planning and what they're doing that we don't necessarily know is going on. So look as if you're being very cooperative, but holding back things that you don't want them to know. And so what it, you know, comes across in the texts, like I'm giving them information, but it's information that they already have, you know. And so that's the, and, you know, I probably explained this already, but, you know, they let me know that they were just, they were about to attack the Black Bloc. You know, they said, okay, we're going in. And I'm like, the Black Bloc would not connect with us. And so I had no way of warning them that this was about to happen. And in subsequent rallies and actions, we did set up a signal group where we had communication, and we were able to, it was much better. But anyway, I mean, there were situations where I knew that when the police attacked the Black Bloc, that folks in the Black Bloc would try to run into our rally to escape. And which would draw the police into attacking our rally. And so our agreement was that we were going to, anybody coming into our rally was going to unmask, was not going to be wearing a mask. And that turned into a huge controversy. And I was directing that. And I, eventually regretted and backed off from doing that. But
can you explain more about that? One, just really quickly, who the Black Bloc are, because they are, I think it's important to sort of describe what they are and what they stand for as a group, because they're still in the press.
Yeah. Sure. Well, it's there are a number of different groups, and they're generally what are called affinity groups. That is, closed groups of friends who decide to all dress in black and wear masks to prevent, being recognized or arrested by the cops, and thereby being able to do things like throw things or spray paint things or set fires to things. And masking and wearing black so that everybody looks alike. And I would generally characterize them as anarchist, though that's not always, not necessarily the case. And there's a whole range of discipline, or lack of discipline among these groups. So there's groups like Rose City Antifa, Rose City Anti-Fascists, who have been around for quite a while, decade or more, whose primary focus is on reducing the impact of the fascists organizing, doing everything from exposing people to their employers, doing research on who these individuals are and who their leaders are, to leading, with banners or in these rallies, or even being very effective in de-escalating conflict. On the other hand, there are groups that are hell-bent on provoking the cops by throwing things at them, which is not something that Rose City Antifa does, but that people who hang out with them do, right? And so when we've been, for example, when, well, this has happened a number of times, and even in recent, you know, the last year, where we make arrangements with folks like Rosin y Antifa for, you know, security or whatever, and then they don't have control of the folks that are associated with them. You know, it's like, so you have, you know, a bunch of people drawing cops into beating up people who are, you know, even innocent bystanders, because a bunch of people want to smash some windows. Anyway, I mean, I don't know if that tells you enough, but
yeah,
I've unfortunately in the latest round of the upsurge of the Black Lives Matter movement over the summer, there has, you know, although it started with, you know, even tens of thousands of people in the streets marching peacefully, it's devolved, particularly over the winter, to what I call the window smashers, who just want to their strategy is that property destruction is going to change policy, and you know, whereas there's some truth to that in some circumstances. I don't think that they've effectively been growing the mass movement. They've actually been reducing it in recent times. But in any case, so that was, and Portland Stands United Against Hate fell apart. For a number of different reasons, but
when did it fall apart?
In about 2000, within a year. It's too complicated. I'm not going to go into all of it.
What was it generally? And if it doesn't make sense to go into that specifically, was it just a matter of too many people involved or too many different affinity groups?
Well, it was a struggle for leadership and And I think this shaming thing that happens in coalitions sometimes, where people are called out for mistakes, and then, you know, you're done. Get out, call out and cancel, kind of thing that happens. Rather than, you know, we have to figure out a way to work with each other and grow. Let's see what are we leaving out? Oh, the Portland Tenants United piece was a really important part of work I was doing over years. And got me involved. I can't even remember why or how I got involved. But I think the most memorable piece was that was my involvement with the houseless communities. And there was a whole campaign over the summer. Whew, what summer was that? It must have been 2017 or 16 or something like that, where the mayor, who I think at the time It was Adams and then Wheeler. Is that right? Or was there somebody in between?
I don't remember.
Right, I think that's right. Anyway, so I think it was Adams. Anyway, so they, you know, from the crash, the economic crash of 2008, the houseless situation has just ballooned, and there's encampments everywhere, and the downtown, you know, businesses of course wanted people out of downtown, and of course houseless people wanted to stay downtown because that's where the social services are and the access to food and medical care and all that. And so the mayor basically said, well, if you go out on the Springwater Trail, we won't hassle you. And the Springwater Trail is this green space along Johnson Creek on the southern border of Portland. And so this whole huge encampment, houseless encampments, it was actually a bunch of different encampments along the Springwater Trail from, who was out to 82nd, 92nd, all the way to the river. And then the mayor changed his mind and decided that he was going to, that everybody had to leave. And so there was an organizing effort, which I got involved with through the Portland Tenants United, because of course we saw the struggle of people against evictions as the same as the struggle of houseless people. And we got involved with these big meetings along Springwater Trail, out in fields, bringing people from their tent cities to talk about how to stay, how to resist, how to figure out how to stop these evictions. And it was such a learning experience for me to find out the stories, of these houseless people, who most of them were from nearby, and I remember taking one woman and her belongings from a camp on the Springwater to another camp further east, because of course you evict people from one spot and they end up in another. And her just pointing out to me, I used to live there and that was the church I used to go to. And this is, people end up often, on the street close to where they were housed or close to where they grew up or close to, wherever they feel connected. And, but also that the idea of actually refusing to leave and getting arrested and losing all your stuff, it was, even though people were talking that line, when it came down to actually resisting when the cops showed up, like, people weren't going to do it. And this is still happening today. At Laurelhurst Park is one of the main sites of resistance, where there are dozens of, housed people like myself who are trying to assist folks who are being evicted because of the pressures, of the surrounding neighborhood. I've continued to be a great proponent and defender of self-managed, houseless encampments, because I saw tons of them, where people would cluster in, groups of 6 or 15, and, provide for each other and take care of each other and provide, look out for each other. And anyway.
Well, what did you end up doing with Portland Tenants United? Was it mostly about work with the houseless, or was there other efforts that you were involved with?
Well, I think I just mostly showed up for at rallies at like different housing complexes where tenants were organizing to, you know, get repairs or resist rent increases. You know, rallies against Senator Rod Monroe, who was a landlord who was doing some nefarious things in one of his apartment complexes. And we actually, again, similar to what happened with getting Chloe Udaly elected to the city council, Portland Tenants United was instrumental again in losing, Rod Monroe losing his Senate race against or maybe he dropped out, I can't remember. But a housing advocate took his place, but I don't even remember who it is now. I can't keep track.
That was due to political organizing that Portland Tenants United was doing to both support Chloe Udaly and
getting rid of Senator Rod Monroe. And we did things like we showed up at his church on a Sunday morning. I remember that. To try to shame him, we did effectively. But the other action around houseless, defense of houseless people that I was very involved with was the Village of Hope, which basically gathered together people who were already camping in and out around the airport. I can't remember the name of the area, but they decided to bring together a village that would they raise money for, you know, porta potties and actually had arranged for being able to set up a kitchen. And on one day, just brought in all this stuff into this one space in this, forested park. And I'm sorry, I can't tell you exactly the location. It was planned by this coalition associated with the Village Coalition, which is, you know, these people who are being supportive of these various encampment, these self-managed camps. And, platforms and put tents on platforms and had raised the money for the porta potties and for garbage collection and for water and all that. And so I think it was the initial encampment was maybe 12 or 15 tents. And then, you know, the city eventually send in cops to force people out, and people were ready to were going to resist and be arrested, and some people did. But we also took it to City Hall, and several times we occupied a city council chambers, you know, demanding that the commissioner of parks, who was at the time Amanda Fritz, who I thought would be more supportive. she comes out of the labor movement and, you know, had this whole association with Jobs with Justice, and I certainly had a relationship with her. Wouldn't go for this city sanctioned encampment. And we had experience with, establishing self-managed camps in the Right to Dream 2 down at 4th and Burnside, prior to that, Dignity Village And then after that, Hazelnut Grove in North Portland. And then we had hoped that we would be able to establish this Village of Hope and basically defend it politically, you know, basically, you know, assemble enough political power to get the city to allow these encampments to exist and even provide some kind of funding. But we were unsuccessful with the Village of Hope. And even though we occupied Amanda Fritz's office and got a commitment from her to, you know, figure out a way to make this work, it didn't happen. But I remain hopeful that, you know, this whole, it's turning into a movement to establish tiny houses, which, you know, has certainly happened at places like Hazelnut Grove and the Kenton Women's Village and some other places. There's too much. Meanwhile, all these sweeps are still happening and people are being, you know, losing their stuff and going to jail.
And by sweeps, just for the sake of those listening.
Oh, right. That means, eviction, where cops move in and arrest people and take their stuff or force people out in locations. Yeah.
Okay. So anyway. Well, we have maybe four or five minutes. Do we want to talk about Don't Shoot PDX as it now, or should we wait until next time?
Sure. I think that let's see, what do I want to say about Don't Shoot Portland?
We have talked about Teresa Rayford, who you have had a relationship with for many years, and the sort of origin story of that, the rally that you and she went to, and she asked what you were going to do, and you weren't prepared for that. Right. And then that really is where it Don't Shoot Portland grew out of that. Is that correct?
Yes. And it was, you know, just a series of street actions. It was like for the longest time, there was a, you know, one go-to tactic, which was marches and blockades, street blockades. I remember once we did, there wasn't even a, there wasn't really a police reform agenda beyond, you know, justice for the individual Black people that had been killed by the Portland police. And that is justice, meaning that the police officers be held accountable, the specific police officers. And the movement has evolved, you know, become much more sophisticated and much more policy oriented and multi-tactic. And, you know, I'm still have my hand in it, but back then I remember doing things like having 15 people and blocking the Fourth Avenue in front of City Hall, you know, for like hours, and the cops not doing anything. And it was like so different. And I remember at that time we had this idea that if you had, you know, 50 people, you could take the street and you could, you know, shut down traffic and the cops wouldn't try to go after you. it's changed so much, in the last, the last 6 months with the, the militarized police and, lots of tear gas and less than lethal munitions and all kinds of ways that the cops are beating up on people. But the movement is, I think, much stronger now and has certainly bypassed Don't Shoot Portland, which has kind of taken on a the character of whatever Teresa Raiford wants to be doing at the moment, which for a while was building out art projects, and her whole political involvement started with defense of mutual support among families whose children had been killed, not just by police, but whose children had been killed in gang violence. And she, I think this whole, was it her nephew that was killed in gang violence that got her connected with, police and the gang task force and figuring out that they weren't being helpful in the first place. So, but she, then she went off and ran for mayor, and I just kind of distanced myself from all that because it didn't seem to be building the movement in an effective way that the Black Lives Matter movement was, and this whole defund the police to fund true community safety has really made some strides. And and now we're intervening with the police, trying to get a community-centered police contract to try to be able to hold police accountable for excessive use of force. And I think we're getting somewhere. We're in the middle of that right now.
Okay, well, I think that's a good place to pause then.
Jack.
We'll be back next time.